Last Lord's Day morning, we almost concluded chapter 19. We want to talk briefly about the last two verses of that chapter, and then we will begin looking at chapter 20 and perhaps chapter 21. When we get to the end of chapter 21, we shall have finished the second round of speeches, and in chapter 22, we'll begin the third round. The third round is the shortest round of all of the speeches, at least with Job's three friends. We'll discover that Eliphaz still has somewhat to say in chapter 22. Bildad, bless his heart, runs out of things to say in chapter 25. And if you'll look, it's the shortest chapter in the book of Job, has about six verses in it, but that's all Bildad can come up with. And Zophar is just out of soap altogether. He doesn't have a third speech. And then we're going to have a brief interlude in chapter 28, and then we're going to start with the fourth person who appears on the scene, and that is Elihu. Elihu is a young man. Now, he doesn't speak until Job gets through with what he has to say. But when we finally get over to Elihu, he says, "Well, I'm young, and I thought I ought to keep quiet." Now, you might think he had some good training, but I think really Elihu was just sort of laying it on pretty thick, because he said, I really thought that wisdom ought to teach youth, but basically he's saying, you old guys don't know what you're saying, you don't know what you're doing, and it's going to take a young man like me to straighten you all out. So we'll get to Elihu down the road. But this morning we're still in chapter 19 and concluding the second round of speeches. Verses 28 and 29, Job has just finished his expression of soaring faith. His faith reaches its height, we suggested in the verses immediately preceding, when he says, "I know that my Redeemer lives, and at the last he will stand upon the earth, and I shall see God." As he concludes the chapter, he says, "If you say, how shall we persecute him, and what pretext for a case against him can we find? Then be afraid of the sword for yourselves, for wrath brings the punishment of the sword, so that you may know there is judgment." Basically, what Job is doing here, he's wrapping up his speech with a warning to his friends. You're saying, "What can you do to me? How can you persecute me?" You just remember that when you're doing that, there is a day of judgment coming. And when that day of judgment comes, then you're going to receive what you are meeting out to me. And you will face a bigger problem than I've got. Because in essence, he's implying here, all I've got to do is deal with you three guys. But when that final judgment comes, you're going to have to deal with God. So when you're persecuting me and you're going through the statements that you're going through, you remember that God and His judgment is in your future. Now, having said that, Job turns silent, and Zophar begins to speak in chapter 20. Now, Zophar's opening comments here in chapter 20 relate to the warning that Job has just given in verses 28 and 29, and Zophar feels sort of insulted because of what Job has said. After all, Zophar feels that he's one of the fellows in the white hats. He feels that he is on God's side, that he is God's servant. And when Job says, "God will get you," Zophar feels sort of insulted by that. And so he first of all responds to what he considers to be Job's insult. And then he proceeds to continue to express his variation of the theme that we have seen on the part of these three friends all through their speeches, and that is the fate of the wicked. These three people, these three friends, in all of the arguments that they have given, have had absolutely nothing to say about Job's argument that the righteous also suffer, the righteous also die, and they die occasionally prematurely. The problem that these three friends have is, as we have discussed, their theology just does not admit at all even the possibility that the righteous are going to suffer. The argument, again, all through the book and continuing has been that suffering is indicative of sin. Job is suffering. Therefore, Job is a sinner. And Zophar continues his discussion along that line. Then Zophar the Naamathite answered, "Therefore my disquieting thoughts make me respond even because of my inward agitation. I listen to the reproof which insults me, and the spirit of understanding makes me answer." You can hear by what Job says, by what Zophar says, that he's been stung by Job's comments. And he has claimed to be wise. And Job has discredited his claim to be wise. And as a result of that, Zophar concentrates in his speech here in verses 2 and 3 on his understanding. And he parades his great understanding in front of Job. "I'm the fount of wisdom," so to speak. And having paraded his wisdom in front of Job, he then proceeds to base his speech on something else. And that is the fount of ancient wisdom. And he bases his assertions he's fixing to make here on this timeless wisdom that he says Job should know. "Do you know this from of old?" And some Hebrew scholars suggest that when the Hebrews spoke with certitude, they sometimes eliminated the not. And so some translations, based upon that aspect of Hebrew language, put the word not in here. "Don't you know this from of old?" It is something that Zophar asserts that everybody knows. Don't we do that as parents sometimes? We get our kids doing something that we know they know better than. There is no doubt in our mind but that they know better than what they're doing. And we don't start by saying, "You know," we say, "Don't you know?" Sure we do. And that's exactly what Zophar's doing here. "Don't you know? You know this. And you know it from of old, from the establishment of man on earth." Now that makes it pretty ancient knowledge, doesn't it? It's been around a pretty good while. It's as old as man is. And Zophar expresses great surprise that Job is not acquainted with this ancient wisdom. Well, what is it that everybody knows? Have you ever noticed that sometimes when you get into, well, maybe I shouldn't use the word argument. Let's just use the word discussion. And all of a sudden, somebody says, "Everybody knows that." Have you ever found the discussion gets sort of short when you ask them, "Who is everybody?" "Well, I can't name one, but everybody knows that." Well, maybe you can go do a little research and find one. Well, that'd be a waste of everybody know. Okay. That's exactly where Zophar is. Now, what does everybody know? Verses 5 to 11 Everybody knows the joy of the godless is grief. Now, question. When Zophar says everybody knows that the life of the godless is brief, does that really respond to Job's position? I don't think so. Why not? Because Job has already argued that everybody's life is brief. Good, bad, rich, poor. That's the nature of human life. It's faster than a weaver's shuttle. It's here today, gone tomorrow. So, Zophar just looking at half of the argument. Job has already argued that the life of all men is transitory. It doesn't make any difference whether they're good or by their, whether they're evil. So what's Zophar doing? Zophar is trying to respond to Job while at the same time evading at least half of the argument that Job has made. Now, what does that imply? I think it implies that by his concession, or by his evasion, I should say, Zophar has basically conceded that the experience of life does not support what Zophar is about to say. Because if life and if experience supported what Zophar is about to say, then Zophar could just address all of Job's argument. But he doesn't do that. Now, what does that mean? Doesn't it suggest that Zophar has sort of moved over closer to Job's position? That God's justice in the final analysis is not based upon observation. You cannot always just look out and based upon human reasoning decide God is just or God is unjust. God's justice is ultimately based on faith and hope. I believe in God. God's nature is just. And so whatever I see, even if I can't understand it, even if I can't explain it, it doesn't affect God's justice at all. All it does is imply that my understanding is deficient. All it does is imply that my information is inadequate. Because bottom line to everything is my faith and my hope that God is just. And that is the faith and hope that Job has expressed all through this book. The Lord gives, the Lord takes away. We receive good from the hand of the Lord. Shall we not also receive evil? But though he slay me, yet will I trust him, because he is just, and everything's going to be just in God's eyes, and I believe in God. What does Zophar say? That the triumphing of the wicked is short. They may have some pretty good days, but they don't last. The joy of the godless is momentary. Though his loftiness reaches the heavens and his head touches the clouds, he perishes forever like his refuse. Those who have seen him will say, where is he? The retribution is swift. The retribution is dramatic. Because this great man of the world who has risen as high as the clouds is brought down by God like the snap of a finger, and his destruction is so complete that people say, huh, where'd he go? Where is he? He flies away like a dream, and they cannot find him. Even like a vision of the night, he is chased away. The eye which saw him sees him no more, and his place no longer beholds him. His sons favor the poor, and his hands give back his wealth. His bones are full of his youthful vigor, but it lies down with him in the dust. His riches are gone. He dies prematurely. The emphasis here is upon the brevity of even the good things that the wicked enjoy. Verses 12 to 18, Zophar continues. And as we read through verses 12 to 18, I think you'll notice that there's certainly a certain realism about what Zophar is saying here in these verses. The facts that he recites in these verses are not without foundation. And Zophar here, he said, God's retribution is swift. But he sort of hedges his bet here and says, but if it is delayed, it's because God is using the wicked man's own wickedness to bring about his downfall and his destruction. Though evil is sweet in his mouth, and he hides it under his tongue, though he desires it and will not let it go, but holds it in his mouth, he's got it, he's savoring it, he's making it last. I remember when I was a kid growing up, there were certain things we did not do in my family. One of them was eat candy in church. This is a cough drop, people. It is not candy. I'm not going back on my raisins. This is medicinal. But when we went to San Antonio to visit Grandma, Mom would be sitting here, Grandma would be sitting there, and the kids would be down the row. And first thing you know, how many of you are familiar with Crystal Mint Lifesavers? That's what Grandma always had. And they'd come down behind her back to the kids, and they always came with a message. Don't chew them. Suck them. They last longer. Grandma didn't want to use too many of her Crystal Mints. But put it under your tongue. Savor it. Make the flavor last. Enjoy it. And that's exactly what Zophar's saying here. Here's the wise man with his riches, with his wealth, and he puts it under his tongue, and he enjoys it. He savors it. He makes the flavor last. But while he is doing that, something happens to it. Yet his food in his stomach is changed to the venom of cobras within him. He swallows riches, but will vomit them up. God, see who's doing it? God will expel them from his belly. He sucks the poison of cobras, the viper's tongue slays him. He does not look at the streams, the rivers flowing with honey and curds. He returns what he has attained and cannot swallow it. As to the riches of his trading, he cannot even enjoy them. And one reason, and this is about the greatest crime charged in the Old Testament against the rich, he has oppressed and forsaken the poor. He has seized the house which he has not built. He may have it and he may savor it for a while, but God's retribution comes and it will get him. Verses 20 to 22. The translations vary, and the verses are not just absolutely clear. They may suggest several things. They may suggest that the rich man, this is certainly true, is dissatisfied with what he has, and he always wants more. It may indicate that the rich man, as just discussed, has a very dramatic reversal of fortune as he lives his life and seeks to enjoy his wealth. It may indicate, and this is true as well, that when he falls into suffering, his suffering is worse than it is for normal folks because he's gotten used to having so much. I mean, when the maid doesn't bring his orange juice in the morning, and not only has he lost his maid, he's lost his orange juice. When he doesn't have the servants to say, go thither and come hither, to do his bidding and to do his will, when all of a sudden he has to get out in the field and work instead of directing others, his suffering is intensified because, you see, he never had any calluses on his hands. He never learned what it was like. Because he knew no quiet within him, he does not retain anything he desires. Nothing remains for him to devour, therefore his prosperity does not endure. In the fullness of his plenty, he will be cramped. He won't even enjoy it when he's got plenty, because he always wants more. The hand of everyone who suffers will come against him. He will have no friends. Verses 23 to 28. You want to know what the subject is? Look down in verse 29. This is the wicked man's portion from God, even the heritage decreed to him by God. Now, what does God do to the wicked man? What is the heritage that he gives him? He may flee from the iron weapon, but the bronze bow will pierce him. If we were saying this in modern language, what would we say? You can run, but you can't hide. He's going to flee the iron weapon, but he can't hide from it. The bow is going to get him, and the bronze arrow will pierce him. It's going to go, as we say, plumb through him. It is drawn forth and comes out of his back. Even the glittering point from his gall, it has gone through his innards, it has struck his gallbladder, and it glitters with his gall as it comes out the backside. He has fears, he has darkness, he has fire, all of the dreads of man. Terrors come upon him, complete darkness is held in reserve for his treasures, and unfanned fire will devour him. It will consume the survivor in his tent, in his household, in his estates, in his family. I think tent there stands for all of that. And even Zophar admits that the wicked man recognizes a final, decisive day of the wrath of God. The heavens will reveal his iniquity, and the earth will rise up against him. The increase of his house will depart. His possessions will flow away in the day of his anger, God's anger. This is the wicked man's portion from God, even the heritage decreed to him by God. Thus ends Zophar's last speech. Remember that we said earlier that Zophar does not have a speech. In the third round of speeches, he has no more to say. Job's last speech in this round, chapter 21. Job sort of has reached the point of saying Gentlemen, I've had enough. The time has come for Job to demolish his friend's position. And in this speech, there is more of a debate than we have seen in prior speeches of Job, because Job actually refers to some of the prior comments that the friends have made and responds to them. From that standpoint, you might want to remember chapter 21, because it can help in the interpretation of the book of Job, because of Job's reference and comments concerning prior statements that have been made. Job's words here are probably less emotional and less invective than some of his words have been in some of the prior speeches that he made. Then Job answered, "Listen carefully to my speech, and let this be your way of consolation. Bear with me that I may speak, then after I have spoken, you may mock. As for me, is my complaint to man? And why should I not be impatient? Look at me, and be astonished. And put your hand over your mouth. Even when I remember, I am disturbed, and horrors take hold of my flesh." Job is angered by the lack of sympathy that his friends have expressed toward him. He suggests to them that a more fitting response would be to be appalled or to be astonished. Verse 5, "Look at me and be astonished." Some translations say appalled. "Look at me. Be astonished." Another appropriate response would be to just sit in silence and look. 5b, "Put your hand over your mouth." Another appropriate response would be just to listen to what he's saying. "Listen carefully to my speech." Verse 2. And what would that be? That would be your consolation. "You have come, and by your speech you have tried to console me, but miserable comforters are you all." Remember that? "You may have come to comfort me, but gentlemen, you're doing a pretty poor job. You have added to my pain, you have added to my problems. You would give me better consolation if you would just be quiet." How many of us have been in position where we have maybe tried to avoid situations and avoid people with problems because we just don't know what to say? Well, I'll tell you, without hesitation, that anybody who knows what to say on every occasion is a whole lot smarter than I am and a whole lot smarter than anybody I ever met. I'm pretty good at knowing what to say, but usually it's 2 or 3 days after the event. "Boy, I wish I had said this." Of course, by the time I've told the story 5 times, I said that. The story gets better with the telling. Maybe you and I need to take a lesson from Job. That the magic, if I may use that word, is very often not found in knowing what to say, but in knowing where to be. And just being willing to listen while people pour out their hearts and pour out their souls and talk through their problems. And that's what Job is saying to these people. If you just come and sat here with me in silence, not just the 7 days that they did, but Job's suggesting, well, things were a lot better then. That would be your consolation, and you could console me just because you're a friend and just because you're here. But he's lost faith in them. You bear with me and let me say what I have to say, and then you can mock. Verse 4, he implies again that God is the source of his trouble. Is my complaint to man? No. His complaint has been and continues to be with God. Now, strangely enough, this is common ground for Job and for his friends, isn't it? Because that's what his friends have been saying all along. Yeah, Job, you got a problem with God. And God is making you pay for your sins. So that's sort of a common ground that the problem is with God. They just disagree as to the cause of it. Now, Job really wants them to listen. Look at me. Parents, you ever say that to the young'uns? Now, you look at me. You're fixing to tell them something that they don't want to hear. And you want to be sure that they're listening. So you try to get their attention. You look at me now. And we probably add what Job added to you. You look at me now, and you be quiet. Now, Job was a little more diplomatic. Put your hand over your mouth. But the message is the same. Job has something to say, and he wants them to listen. Verses 7 to 16. We suggested earlier that the friend's thesis is that sin produces suffering. And their influence from their thesis is that suffering proves sin. And their conclusion from their thesis and from their inference is that Job is a sinner. And God's dealing with him as a sinner. Job denies both of those things. Why do the wicked still live? Remember what Zophar said back here in chapter 20 and verse 11? His bones are full of his youthful vigor, but in his youth, that youthful vigor lies down with him in the dust. It's just as dead as he is. They die while they're young. Job asked him a pretty good question. Well, then why do the wicked still live? Continue on, also become very powerful. Not only, Zophar, do the wicked not always die in their youth, they live on, and as they live on, they become very powerful. Not only that, but the wicked also seem to have happy and large families. Verse 8, their descendants are established with them in their sight, and their offspring before their eyes. Remember what Bildad said back in chapter 18, verse 19? Talking of the wicked who has no offspring or posterity among his people, nor any survivor where he sojourned. And Job is saying, gentlemen, look around you. And here the wicked have large, they have happy families, everything seems to be going well with them. Their houses are safe from fear. Neither is the rod of God on them. Now, the houses of the wicked are secure. You know, you watch the movies about the mafiosa, and they've always got these big old guys with the big old guns, the machine gun, walking around the perimeter of their house, and you sort of step one toe over the line, and they throw you back bodily, dead. Their houses are secure. They've got the armies. They've got the servants. They can take care of themselves. They don't have any problems. And more than that, neither is the rod of God on them. You remember what Job prayed for back in chapter 9 and verse 34? Why didn't God take his rod away from me? Job felt that the rod of God was on him. He said, look at the wicked. The rod of God is not on them. Doesn't fall on them. His ox mates without fail. His cow calves and does not abort. His cattle are fertile. His herds and his flocks just grow and grow. And then he describes some very idyllic conditions. They send forth their little ones like the flock, and their children skip about. They sing to the timbrel and harp and rejoice at the sound of the flute. They spend their days in prosperity, and suddenly they go down to Sheol. And they say to God, depart from us. We do not even desire the knowledge of thy ways. Who is the Almighty that we should serve him? And what would we gain if we entreat him? Behold, their prosperity is not in their hand. The counsel of the wicked is far from me. Having described the idyllic conditions in verses 11 and 12, verse 13, Job says, they die with no ill effects. In verses 14 and 15, he suggests that the wicked enjoy all of this while they are engaging in the most presumptuous profanity in which they could engage. They say to God, go away. Don't bother me. We don't want to know anything about you. We don't want to know anything about your ways. Who is this God that we should serve? We're doing pretty good on our own. What would we gain if we entreated him? What would we get that we don't now have if we sought out this God of yours? Behold, their prosperity is not in their hands. Job is saying they didn't get this by their own efforts, which implies that God is blessing them and providing things to them, but he concludes by saying, I will have none of it. I'll have none of the counsel of the wicked. I will cling to God. I will cling to my righteousness. Now let me ask you something. Job is saying, here the wicked have all of this, but I'll have none of it. I will cling to God. Did Job have all of the answers at this point? Don't think so. Job still had all of his questions. And we're going to see him asking more of these questions as we come down to it. Look at verse 7. Why? Why, God? Why do things go like this? How long, God, will they continue on this wise? You and I need to understand that belief in God does not enable us to answer all of the questions of life. It does not enable us to understand all of the apparent inequalities of life. It does not provide us explanations of everything that happens under the sun. But you and I also need to understand that what we need is the faith of Job. You see, by Job's standards, any faith that could not live every day under all of the circumstances of life, whatever they may be, with continuing trust and confidence in God, is absolutely worthless. Turn over to Philippians chapter 4. And in closing, we'll read a fine commentary on that kind of faith that Job possessed. Beginning verse 11, "Not that I speak from want, for I have learned to be content in whatever circumstances I am. I know how to get along with humble means, and I also now know how to live in prosperity. In any and every circumstance, I have learned the secret of being filled and going hungry, both of having abundance and suffering need. I can do all things through Him who strengthens me." That, I suggest, is the beautiful faith that Job had. He still had his questions. He still didn't have the answers. But he still had a faith that trusted in God despite his bad circumstances. We'll begin there next Lord's Day morning. Thank you for your presence and attention this morning.